The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Russell Napier is one of our favorite but most cherished guests. We treat his interviews like a jewel. You know, we in the crisis back in June, Dave, 2008, we wanted Russell Napier on, the author of Anatomy of the Bear. And in November, we brought him back on because we were right there in 2008 in the crisis. Then we waited a couple of years, brought him back in March of 2010 and April of 2012. Here we are on the cusp of what seems to be a crisis. Granted, people are falling asleep, but it's a cusp of a crisis. It's time to have Russell back.
The conversation is always intriguing, and it's certainly time to put your thinking cap on and schedule the time to go through and listen twice. But more than that, I would say make sure you order Anatomy of the Bear. This is a book that he wrote some years ago, but it's just as relevant to the long-term trends and where you want your family to be in those long-term trends on the right side of them. And so, without further ado, Russell, our conversations, again, beginning in June 2008, Lehman was getting their first downgrade, have been critical in content, and I think in timing. If our listening audience had at any time over the last 5 years paid careful attention and learned from your insights, Russell, the debt owed to the Napier family would be great indeed. It's great to have you back again. We still live in fascinating times. I'd like to circle back around to a few big picture issues and mention how some of your analysis has panned out in the time we've been talking. But before that, what captures your attention right now?
Well, what's really capturing my attention is the emerging markets. And I'm sure people listening will realize there was quite a reaction to the word tapering in emerging markets. I don't think the word tapering was actually as important as people think, but I think it was underlying showing an underlying fragility in the emerging markets. I'm particularly concerned about ones in Eastern Europe. Even in our last couple of decades, we have had a few emerging market crises, and I'm afraid there's another one brewing, particularly in Eastern Europe. So as you know, there are many, many things to talk about in the global economic outlook, but that one concerns me because it's big, and also because nobody else is talking about it, or very few people seem to be talking about it.
Well, you have the balance of payments surpluses, which drove the purchase of treasuries. And as we continue the course of economic rebalancing on a global basis, I guess you would contend that emerging markets are impacted. And in turn, I guess we here in the United States would be impacted as well. Do you want to look at that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my great concern when we've spoken before that it is inevitable that this rebalancing takes place. The economic bit of that sounds wonderful. We go slightly faster, they go slightly slower. You know, that rebalancing intuitively just sounds like a good term. But I think there's a monetary flaw at the core of this, which is the one that you've alluded to, which is the emerging markets have been pouring a lot of money into treasuries because they've been manipulating their exchange rates and running very large surpluses. And the other part of that, when you do that, you also create lots of domestic currency. And what we saw in the summer with these problems in emerging markets is we've got to a stage where they're not running those surpluses. Now, if you think about the reverse of this, it becomes quite frightening as to what can actually happen if we truly go into the reverse of the situation. In the reverse of the situation, if the emerging markets decided to defend their exchange rates, they would be selling treasuries, and they would also be running tighter monetary policy at home. In other words, selling dollars, buying back the domestic currency, and tightening monetary policy. Now, that is anti-growth. It's anti-growth clearly for the emerging markets themselves. But to the extent that it pushes up U.S. Treasury yields, it's anti-growth in the U.S. And I think we've already seen the role that Treasury yields have played, particularly in mortgage refinancings. But if it clearly at a very low level of interest rates already playing a role in slowing some economic activity in America. So I think that was the beginning. I don't think it was the end of this process. I think it was a tremor on the earthquake that is to come. And it's fairly clearly a deflationary earthquake rather than an inflationary earthquake if it's pushing Treasury yields higher in the States and producing lower growth in emerging markets. So it's been my concern for a couple of years now that the next shock we would have would be a deflationary crisis coming out of emerging markets. And I think the events of the summer showed that we're perilously close to that.
Now, Treasury yields, when you have concerns with deflation, it seems Treasuries are the go-to for anyone with concerns about deflation and deleveraging. This is a little bit different in the context of rising interest rates in a deflationary environment. How would you respond to sort of that knee-jerk reaction to go to Treasuries and potential risks there?
Yeah, well, you're very right. I mean, it's a very extreme forecast I've just made, and the extreme forecast is that U.S. Treasury yields are going to go up as growth comes down and inflation expectations come down, and potentially even they would go up even if America reported deflation. And as you so rightly say, that would be a very, very unusual situation for that to happen. But I think we live in very unusual times. The Fed owns about 20% of the Treasury market. 34% of the Treasury market is owned by other central bankers. So we've got over half that market owned by central bankers. Clearly, over the last two decades, the marginal buyer, well, the central banker's been more than half the marginal buyer if he now owns half the outstanding stock. And the crucial thing here is that that central banker, or those central bankers, in those days decided they wanted to buy treasuries because they liked the price, they liked the yield, they thought it fit in with the economic outlook for the United States of America. They bought it simply to affect their monetary policy, the Fed to affect quantitative easing, the emerging markets to affect currency manipulation. So we always assume, don't we, that the treasury market will respond to economic fundamentals. And that may well be a reasonable forecast. It certainly has been for many decades now. But we're in, a fairly perilous and dangerous situation where half of the treasury market is owned by people who pay no attention to the fundamentals and the economic fundamentals. So it may sound a rather outlandish forecast that treasury yields, let's just say they could be sticky on the way down or they go up a little bit even as U.S. economic growth falls. But I don't think it's as outlandish as it initially seems. So it is difficult to foresee someone losing a lot of money in treasuries as the economy slows and inflation comes down. But I still think you're not going to make a lot of money in treasuries, and I prefer to own cash as a safer way of keeping the optionality of buying equities when they're cheap. And all your listeners will know that in the long run, we all want to be able to invest in equities. We want to buy them when they're cheap. And cash will give us that optionality. And I'm a little bit concerned that bonds will not perform the way they normally have done in the post-war period.
You know, in November of 2008, you and I discussed the future tense sort of bypassing of the commercial banking system and the Fed directly purchasing assets, quantitative easing. You were right. It has happened. If that was a final solution for preventing deflation, I mean, how have they done? And you know, you see M2, MZM, the annualized numbers there, they're looking a bit inflationary, but there's really not much inflation if you look at the total amount of easy credit, easy money monetization that's been put in place from a policy perspective directed by the Fed.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. It seems to have been good for money, but not good for credit. It is interesting that quantitative easing really is, we have to attribute it to Irving Fisher in his 1933 paper. And he said it was important, this policy was important because we keep money growing. He never actually mentioned credit. He said we keep money growing. And then in the process of a deleveraging, that would mean that it would be just like putting oil into the machine of a deleveraging. It would stop the friction building up, and it would stop bankruptcies. And I won't go into all the details of that, but basically that seems to work. But what doesn't happen is what the Fed has really claimed for quantitative easing, that it would encourage people to relever, perhaps encourage people to save less and spend more. And if that, the Fed really think that that will happen, and Fisher certainly didn't say that that would happen, but the Fed seems to think that will be part of the process, I think there's not much evidence that that actually is working. And one of the potential reasons for that is the just the demographics of America and the baby boom generation. And I think it may be true to say that there is no price of interest at which the baby boom generation would borrow more and save less, given the precarious situation of their personal finances and just their age. And they're moving into an age where they have to change. So I don't think that deflation, despite relatively high money supply growth, my last time I looked at our reconstituted M3, it was running just over 5%. We're saying that's a fairly low number by the sort of average of the last 20 or 30 years. But obviously, it's a number significantly better than we were in early 2009. But in a world where the private sector, and particularly the household sector, continues to de-gear, and as I said, where I think particularly emerging markets push deflation into America through lower commodity prices and now lower manufactured good prices, and where the Japanese are aggressively cutting prices through depreciating the yen, I think the combination of those things, so not really a collapse in America, but just a stagnation in credit, a lack of growth in America at a time when emerging markets are slowing and the Japanese are exporting deflation. I think putting those things together, we probably get an America heading towards deflation despite quantitative easing.
Russell, the idea that there is sort of a natural deleveraging embedded in our demographics, you know, that age bracket 55 and above who are now moving towards retirement and want to reduce their cash outflows to interest payments and be more or less debt-free. that does fly in the face of credit growth, and credit growth has been one of the key drivers of U.S. economic growth. So what do you think the policies will be of the Fed? I mean, have we exhausted our options, or will we see even more in unique creativity coming from the new Fed president?
I think you'll see more unique creativity. That's a wonderful euphemism for what central bankers get up to. I wish I thought of that, unique creativity. That's one of the nicer things you could say about them. If you want to see unique creativity in action, come to the United Kingdom. And I think we have a template here for where you will be in the not-too-distant future. And that is really the government and the central bank working together. So what we have going on here through a policy called Funding for Lending, and also a separate policy called Help for Homes, is the state effectively putting its stamp, state credit, on loans flowing from the commercial banking system to the private sector, to small corporations, and also to households for the purchases of homes. Now, I realize with in the United States, you started that process in 1932. In fact, for farm mortgages, you started it well before 1932, but it's new here, and it's working. But you can see how it could also go in America. It can't really go into mortgages because it's already there, but the Funding for Lending, which is putting a state in premature on loans to small companies, you have some of that in America, but that could get more aggressive. But you can see the conjunction of the two. Now, that can work here in the United Kingdom. In my opinion, it's effectively turning our central banker into a commercial bank. He's providing the funds for the commercial bank, who then passes those funds out into the private sector with a state guarantee. But it'll come to America, I think, in a different way, because it's very difficult at the minute to foresee how Congress would endorse such a combination. You know, the British government is a government. It can get things done. And you have a certain stagnation inside the Beltway, which may mean that form of cooperation is not available. Now, whether you politically like that form of cooperation or not, I think it's inevitably where we get to. So I can name one policy that we might end up with from the Federal Reserve, but clearly not a Federal Reserve acting alone, a Federal Reserve acting in conjunction with the government. It would be the forgiveness of student debt. We have this generational issue where I think the older generation simply has to de-gear in terms of reflating America, reflating the United Kingdom. It's getting credit flowing to young people. And one of the major impediments to that in the United States is the level of student debt. So there you have it, unique creativity. It needs the politicians as well. Like TARP, you don't get it until you get it, and you don't get it until you get a crisis. But if quantitative easing isn't working, I think this is the shape of things to come.
Central banks looking more like a commercial bank, that while that has a ring of a market dynamic to it, in the backdrop you're really talking about state-directed capital like what we have had for several decades in China and other economies that you could describe as command economies. Is that the inevitable future? I mean, certainly that was a part of our conversation in 2010 and in 2012, the potential for command economy characteristics emerging in the U.S., perhaps U.K. as well. Is that the state of the future? I mean, where we can just expect more involvement in government or from government in the economy?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it, because obviously it's good to mention forecasts that come right. So if that was 2010, we've just got to look at the United Kingdom again. And for any of your listeners, they want to go to the Bank of England website and look up the Financial Policy Committee, which has been established this year. You will see exactly how this works. Now, the role of the FPC is separate from the Monetary Policy Committee, which is our equivalent of the FOMC. And it is going to attempt to control credit with other tools. Now, those tools, without going into the details of them, mean effectively adjusting risk weighting of capital within the banking system to steer credit to or away from certain forms of lending. Now, that is, in my opinion, state-directed credit. Of course, the central bank is not a direct arm of state. It is theoretically independent, but it's certainly not allocating credit by price. It's not allocating credit by its price. It's not making loans based on the price. It's having another tool out there which says, no, we think this, even at this price, we think this is the wrong place for credit to flow to. So it was a 2010 forecast, but it's come true in 2013 for the United Kingdom. We are directing credit to bits of the economy where the central bank wants, other than price. I do think that eventually something similar to that will come to the United States of America. I'd call it a central bank activism. It's not a good thing in terms of the efficient allocation of credit. It's not an efficient allocation of capital, but that is the way forward, and that is the future, and it's come to the United Kingdom already.
So we're really not talking about the unseen hand, but we're talking about the seen hand, central bank activism. It seems to me that the danger lies in loans and credit flowing to the politically connected and the potential for corruption increasing, not decreasing.
I agree with that. When you ration by, the government doesn't like the unseen hand. Rationing by price was something which already delivered in terms of economic growth for a prolonged period of time, and it patently did not. The initial reaction of a government when it doesn't is to abolish it rather than say, well, let's let it work and let's sort itself out. So they've come into this business to try and, as you say, bring in the seen hand. But I actually did a speech at the university last night, and the punchline was, he who seeks to control credit with something other than price ultimately rations it. Now, if we had a list of the people who are most likely to benefit from that rationing, then clearly it would be the government itself, or people who vote for the government or connected to the government. If we say that the long-run outlook for the United States must be to de-gear, and it must be in some way to keep credit growth below nominal GDP growth over the long term, then there's going to be a lot lower credit growth than we've had for the past three decades. For the past three decades, anybody who wanted credit could get it. You just simply paid the price. Now, if paying the price is no longer sufficient because the government or the central bank deems that credit should not be flowing to that part of the economy, then it is going to be rationed to those who need it most. And believe me, in the world of politicians, the people who need credit the most are politicians. So they're going to be top of the list. The voters are going to be second, and everybody else is going to be behind them. So we have had policies like this before. They have not been very successful, but here we go again. At least when a politician makes the same mistake twice, he has the good grace to give it a different name. So this time, credit controls are masquerading under the title of macro-prudential regulation. But in my opinion, it will ultimately amount to the same thing.
We have many changes in the financial markets, and obviously if you're changing these structural relationships, pricing of capital being one of them, and now we've been having prices controlled, manipulated by the Fed now for several years, with interest rates kept extraordinarily low, and through the asset purchases, the programs that we've had in place here as well. Where are we at? Where are we going? Just a quick snapshot. Gold, treasuries, U.S. equities, emerging market equities. Could you say sort of pros and cons for each? How do you think the chips fall?
Okay, it's very difficult to do that quickly, but I think equities are a straightforward avoid, particularly U.S. equities. I think the so-called Shiller PE, which many of your listeners will know well, I think it is a good guide to long-term returns, and it's certainly suggesting that for U.S. equities, long-term returns will be poor, and short-term returns could be very poor. We tend to get a couple of bad years over the long term when you have valuations at this level.
Let's look at that. Yeah, you've got what you call the cyclically adjusted PE or the Shiller PE. It's north of 23 at present.
Yeah, that's correct.
Could it be on its way to 40 before it hits 10?
Well, if we look at for your listeners, they can look that up on Shiller's website, and what you see is that 23 has been a very high level. It's not that far away from where we were in 1929. There is only one period in history where you could buy at 23 times and actually make a lot of money in the short term, and that was from 1995 to 2000. So it's not unheard of that it could go from 23 to 43, because that is what it did from 95 to 2000. But that was the only time in a historical record beginning in 1881 that it did so. So I do think it's a high-risk strategy to say to invest on that basis, but it's clearly it's not out of the question. What you would normally expect with a cyclically adjusted PE or a Shiller PE at 23 is over a 10 to 15 year period, probably about 2 to 2.5% real per annum. But of course, that tells you the long run average return, but not the distribution of returns. And you know, as I suggested, somewhere in that record, you're likely to get a couple of very bad years. So it's only 2.5% real, perhaps, for a 10 to 15 year holder. Treasuries, I think, will become certificates of confiscation. It's just a matter of when that happens. And what I mean by that is the real returns on those will be dreadful. That's always been the way that democracies have shifted their debt. Ultimately, it's been through inflation. And although I'm not an inflationist, clearly in the short run, the next year, the next 2 years, ultimately for the long run investor, there is no value in government debt. Gold is the most interesting one. I think what we have to do is, because gold does not really have a fundamental, it's very difficult to get right. It clearly benefits from that long-run inflation, so I think it is a very good long-run investment. But even in the short run, I think what we're about to see is such a significant economic dislocation, in my opinion, driven by deflation, that you might even see gold start to go up as we get bad economic news coming out, as we get worries about deflation. At that stage, I think it becomes a buy almost instantly. Because what it's telling you, if it starts to react positively to bad economic news and deflationary news, it's telling you that here is an asset class which can actually benefit from deflation and inflation. And therefore, it is going to be the go-to asset class. Cash is much more valuable than people think. I think that would be a key takeaway from this, and I assume we've had this conversation before. Cash has clearly not been a good investment at the minute or the last couple of years. It's deteriorating. Its real value is deteriorating every day. But that small incremental deterioration in its real value is as nothing compared to the significant loss of capital one could undergo in developed world equities or U.S. equities today. So keeping that cash for the optionality to buy equities when they're cheap, I still think has value despite the real losses you make every day. And emerging markets, just finally, I think are a very straight avoid. There's a lot of dangerous things happening in emerging markets. I actually think it's mainly an Eastern European phenomenon rather than a Latin American or a Asian phenomenon. But the whole asset class tends to get dragged down when we have one of these particular regions in trouble. And therefore, I would stay clear of emerging market, and particularly emerging market debt. This is an entirely illiquid asset class crammed into very large open-ended mutual funds sold to the world's pensioners. And frankly, I think it's one of the most dangerous asset classes out there, because this is one where you simply won't be able to extract your capital from, at least emerging market equities. Over many years, they've had their ups and their downs, but it has been possible to get your money out. I suppose one final thing to add on that, because it is hard to cover it all in such so many asset classes so quickly. Your listeners really need to go and listen or read the speech of Christine Lagarde, Jackson Hole, because in that she stated categorically that one of the answers for this problem that emerging markets have in coping with a tighter U.S. monetary policy would be exchange controls, would be the restrictions on people removing their capital from emerging markets. Now, I think that's something which is so important that it's good reason to be cautious in putting any more money into emerging markets. And that's one of the potential responses that's going to be endorsed by the IMF next time we have an emerging market problem.
Well, let's go back and contrast sort of the balance sheet differences between your Asian emerging markets, who obviously benefited tremendously from trade with the West and have sat on surpluses for a long time. Maybe you could say balance sheet strong, but declining on the income side of the equation in terms of an income statement. Your concern is Eastern European countries who maybe have a different balance sheet composition altogether.
Yeah, there's a sort of flows in stocks. And what I mean by a flow is the current account. That is, in any given year, any country, how much it exports and how much it imports at any given point in time. What makes us worried is actually balance sheet items. And if you think of it from a corporate perspective, it's when you combine a poor P&L with a very bad balance sheet. You can sort of get away with a poor P&L and a reasonable balance sheet. So the key indicator for all the emerging markets, as far as I'm concerned, is not necessarily the current account, which is the one people tend to focus on, but it's the scale of their external debt, which is the external debt to GDP ratio. Just how much have they borrowed from offshore? Now, a lot of it they borrow offshore. They borrow actually in foreign currencies, which is very dangerous. They borrow in a foreign currency, use that to finance investment in domestic currency assets. And they're also now borrowing in their local currency from foreigners. But in Eastern Europe, these are the highest numbers we've seen since the Asian economic crisis. And they're basically at levels where you wouldn't expect these countries to be able to pay back. Many of your listeners won't have heard of some of these countries. They're very small, or they sound very small, but they still borrowed tens of billions of dollars. But there's two big ones in Eastern Europe. And they've borrowed well over $300 billion each. And they're important, and they're Poland and Turkey. So even adding in some of the small ones, we find nearly $2 trillion worth, in my opinion, of money emerging markets, Eastern European emerging markets, have borrowed. I think there's a real question mark as to whether they'll pay it back. And $2 trillion, even today, is still quite a lot of money.
Well, just to come full circle to our conversation in 2008, we were talking about $600 billion in exposure with Lehman, and they needed to raise a few billion dollars to keep themselves afloat, and they obviously that came to an end. We're talking about $2 trillion. That dwarfs Lehman.
Absolutely, it does. And there's basically two sets of people who have lent the money. So the risk, obviously, is who has lent this money to Eastern Europe, because that's where the burden will fall. And unfortunately, it is the European banking system. They are one of the big funders of what's been going on in Eastern Europe. And I'm sure you're aware the last thing these banks need is another hit to their capital base from defaults in Eastern Europe. The sad thing is, and I think it's very sad, is that also Western pensioners have now got involved in this trade, this emerging market debt trade, which I think is fundamentally dangerous. That's really been underway since about 2009. The banks have Western Europe have been pretty busy since 2009 sorting out their own mess. So what we find is the loans that they have to Eastern Europe are pretty much the legacy loans that they made before 2009, loans that they haven't been able to get back. But the new level of debt, which has kept the Eastern European party going since 2009, has predominantly come in the form of their bond issuance, which is now resting securely on the balance sheet of the world's developed world's pensioners, who are chasing it for the 5 to 6% yield, which it promises. But that's a yield which is taken, I think, at great risk. So I think we know the transmission mechanism here. It's a transmission mechanism which hurts European banks and therefore slows European growth, but also hurts the West's pensioners and hurts their savings, which is not going to be good ultimately for economic activity in the West.
You know, we have TIC data that does indicate a marginal loss of faith in U.S. government debt. Do we see that as a short-term aberration, a long-term trend? You received some mention in the Financial Times in recent weeks, and the outside number for the S&P, you put it 400. That was mentioned again. Have you revised your estimates any? If not, sort of, what is a step sequence that leads us here in the U.S. to those kinds of numbers? What variables are at work in the market today?
Okay, well, just the justification for the number and where it comes from. It's not a number plucked from mid-air. It's not a number that was chosen to worry people or frighten people. It's simply looking at the cyclically adjusted PE, the Shiller PE, and the previous lows. And there is quite a range in the previous lows. So it's just looking at an average of the previous lows and saying that if the Shiller PE has value because it mean reverts, then there is some valuable information provided to us by the previous lows. Now, many people refute that it will continue to mean revert. They say the mean reversion we've witnessed so far has come to an end. The 1881 to, let's say, 2000 mean reversion is all going to come to an end and it's irrelevant. But if you believe in it, as I do, then we simply take the previous four lows, and that indicates a number which is actually now somewhere between 400 and 500 for the S&P. Your question is, how on earth could we ever see the conditions in place that would drive equity valuations to those levels? Well, I can think of many of them. They have to be big things. Clearly, we only had four of these lows in the last 130 years. They're going to have to be very major things that are happening. But let me give you some potential ones out there. I don't by any means think this will be all of these will happen, but here are some of them. We begin to realize that the Federal Reserve is not a safety net for asset prices, that the printing of money does not necessarily create higher levels of economic growth, higher levels of corporate profits, and higher levels of asset prices. In other words, unlike 2009, when we had a deflationary disease, we had administered a cure, or a seeming cure. Today, if we get that disease coming back despite the cure, there could be a huge loss of faith to say, well, actually, this stuff doesn't work. It doesn't actually underwrite our downside. That could be number one. Number two, I have great fears, as we slightly discussed, on what will happen with foreign central bank ownership of treasuries. If China had to become an aggressive defender of its exchange rate, which is inevitable, I mean, it will happen. You can't undervalue an exchange rate forever. That would involve a significant selling of treasuries, and I think a significant upward movement in U.S. interest rates at a time when the economy may already be struggling. I would say that wouldn't go on for long, but the alternative, which is a Chinese devaluation, would also have major negative issues for global growth in terms of China exporting major deflation. So that adjustment in China when it comes, I think, is the sort of deflationary thing that can bring equity prices extremely low. And I suppose finally, it's just, you know, we have discussed the slow, gradual, structural shift away from markets to government. We do live in a bizarre world where nearly every investor I meet thinks they're going to benefit from this, and they have benefited from it. The initial few years of this has been printing of an attempt to print money, which has driven up asset prices. Corporate profits are at an all-time high relative to GDP. But ultimately, in a world where the government wants to get involved and take over from the markets, do we really think that we're going to be paying higher prices for private sector assets in a world of public sector interference? So the other sort of thing that could bring equity valuations to low levels is just a gradual and gradual and gradual rise in the role of government in the marketplace. It's that famous citation, it's like boiling a frog in water. The water is getting nice and warm at the minute. Everyone's pretty contented. But there's some degree of temperature in that water in which we want to pay significantly less for equities rather than significantly more, which is what we've decided to do in the first 5 years of this great 20, 30-year shift away from markets and back to government.
Well, that was the same air we were breathing in a during the war and then post-World War II era. And that air didn't clear until 1949 when the market could perceive the receding of government from the marketplace and reemergence of private interests. One last thing just on mean reversion in valuation, because if the Shiller PE is a value and yet it's criticized for its mean reversion, if it does or doesn't, what about Tobin's Q? The mean reversion there, I think, is probably even more reliable, and yet it's 2 times its average. I mean, that too would indicate that we're in not necessarily nosebleed sections, but if you're looking at value, you're paying a very high price for it today and probably not getting a very good value.
Yeah, well, I run a course in finance called The Practical History of Financial Markets, and we have a whole section on value there. It's taught by Andrew Smithers, and Andrew Smithers and Stephen Wright have written the book on Tobin's Q. And I would agree with you, Tobin's Q is probably a better measure of value. I simply use the Shiller CAPE because it's also, they both are good. Shiller CAPE is just simply better known. But ultimately, the Q ratio is probably an even better measure of value. And you're right, they both show extreme overvaluation of U.S. equities. They have to date both shown mean reversion. And when I talk about both measures of value, both showing overvaluation, the constant refrain is, well, this time they won't mean revert. Well, I just think it's a big bet. I mean, maybe there is some brand new paradigm in the world where for the first time this isn't going to happen. But if that's the bet you're making, I think it's quite a dangerous bet. And of course, it could be that the world has changed and that's not going to happen again. But that's a dangerous, dangerous thing to do. I mean, I would just say why I think the Q is such an important measure of value. When at its bottom, it shows equities trading at a 70% discount to the replacement value of their assets. Quite remarkable. I cover this in my book. It's almost exactly the same number every time. 70% discount to replacement value of their assets. Why that's important is it stops companies investing. And this is why the world is in a mess. It stops companies investing. Companies simply won't take a dollar of cash flow and invest it in a dollar of assets if the market values them at 30 cents. And that's where China comes in. It's China that's not getting this signal. China is never getting a signal to stop investing. And because China never gets the signal to stop investing, then it just keeps overproducing and we keep getting these deflationary threats. So I think a fall in the Q ratio and something that's similar, getting a signal to China, is what we need to try and stop capital investment, stop overcapacity, and that's when you want to be buying assets. So it's not just a measure of value, which I think tells you when equities are cheap. It also sends the signal to stop producing capital. And that's a great time to buy existing capital and a great time to buy it at a discount. And those signals have not been thrown yet.
So you say it's a big bet that it won't mean revert. I mean, let's take a time frame. And again, just kind of pulling it out of the hat, 2014 to 2016, we talked about some of the potential structural negatives. Those would be, you know, the Federal Reserve not serving as an actual safety net, their policies being ineffective and being found that way in the market, hypothetically. China defending its exchange rate, devaluing the yuan, some major things that could happen. Anything else that you would throw into the mix that could bring 2014 to 2016 into frame, given that, as you've pointed out in your book, The Anatomy of the Bear, the average bear market lasts about 14 years, and we're coming up on that kind of a time frame where you could assume the worst is behind us. And yet, I think what I'm hearing you say is, actually, we've got a long road to hoe still in front of us.
In terms of the timing, it's incredibly difficult. I say the average is 14 years, but we, of course, in terms of the bear markets I look at, and what I'm looking at is peak valuations to low valuations, we haven't got very many of them. I mean, the first one actually lasts from 1900 to 1920, so that's a 20-year one. But when you've got such few observations, I think taking the average is potentially dangerous. So what I tried to do in my book is try to look at the mechanisms that drive the mean reversion. And for me, rightly or wrongly, I've decided that it's actually inflation or deflation, a breakout in inflation above 4% or deflation. And if it's inflation, it tends to bring these valuations down relatively slowly. That was the case, let's just say, from 1968 to 1982. That was primarily an inflationary effect bringing down valuations. So if we're looking at valuations falling to the sort of number we've just mentioned in that 2014-2016 time horizon, that's clearly going to be a very rapid decline in valuations, and that I think would have to be deflation. So, you know, I do see that deflation out there. I do see it on the horizon, and that's why I think valuations can fall quickly. They fell quickly in 29-32, which was a deflationary shock. Even 2000-2003, there was a real risk of deflation. Post Lehman Brothers deflation, this is when equity valuations adjust very rapidly indeed. And I think that's what we have on the cards. So I'm fairly convinced that we'll get the mean reversion. If it's going to be via inflation, it could take 20 years in total from the year 2000, as it did from the year 1900. But if it's going to be inflation, it'll be much more quickly. So this inflation-deflation debate is very important for timing, apart from anything else. And as I made clear, I'm on the deflation side of it, so it could happen quite quickly.
One of the last four major bear markets was deflationary. The other three were inflationary. And the overtones you see, sort of contraction in bank lending, is sort of supportive to the case that this is still, after 5 years, a deflationary environment.
Yeah, I think so, and particularly outside of the United States of America. It's worth stressing, even the losses you make in inflation, you get a long fall and slow fall in the valuation. It ultimately ends with some form of deflation or deflationary fear. I mean, I think even 1982 was an era when, as you pointed out there, that the money center banks looked like they were bust, and if the money center banks were bust, then most of the banks were bust, and we were going to get a major credit contraction. Now, it turned out that Volcker changed his monetary policy, and the banks were saved, and everything was okay. But for a terrible moment, it looked like we could be heading in for another major banking crisis in 1982. So even though the ones where your valuations falls for a long time because of inflation, they ultimately end with some form of deflation, as was the same in 1921 as the Fed tried to squeeze out the World War I inflation. The deflation I see out there is just very rapid slowdown in growth in emerging markets, Japan exporting products much more cheaply. And believe me, the yen has got an awful lot further to fall, and the price of Japanese exports has got an awful lot further to fall. And this comes at a time when the baby boom generation is de-gearing. Those things combined, I think, raise that specter of deflation out there. I was much more optimistic on growth and inflation up until about 2011. It's only then it began to become clear to me that the lack of credit was a demand issue rather than a supply issue. I had expected that when the banks were fixed, they would supply credit and credit would grow. And it becomes clear to me every day that the problem with credit is a demand issue and not a supply issue. And fixing that is significantly more difficult than fixing the supply side.
Well, I'm going to suggest that all of our listeners take about 3 months off and come to Edinburgh, go to the Edinburgh Business School and attend your class, benefit from the expertise and insight that you bring, and also maybe spend a little time in Adam Smith's home. As I understand, the Edinburgh Business School owns the home that he lived in for a good 10, 12 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got even better news for you. You don't have to come for 3 months, because we are one unit of an MBA program. We can teach it all in 2 days, so come for 2 days, and I'll personally take you down to see Adam Smith's house, which the Edinburgh Business School has bought, and they're looking for some money to renovate it. So if you're feeling particularly charitable, you could actually make a contribution and be one of the few people who's contributed to refurbishing that house. And that's where the hope to keep alive the ideas of Adam Smith and his views on the invisible hand in what will be difficult days to come.
Well, Russ, we appreciate your time, and I'm going to take you up on that. That'd be 2 days well spent, and I look forward to it. We just have to figure out where to put it in on the calendar.
Great. See you soon.
Dave, something I don't think a lot of people understand about the author, Russell Napier. Okay, we've heard the interviewee, Russell Napier, these numerous times. But the author, Russell Napier, goes back and reads everything and takes himself through a historic narrative of what he's trying to study. You know, when he was talking about 1982 and the actions of 1982, this is somebody who actually read every article in the Wall Street Journal during that time, because as writing, Davis, he was writing Anatomy of the Bear, he went through virtually a century of Wall Street journals to understand how the markets actually work. And I love the way he can bring the perspective as if he's a man who travels through time.
And I think there are two things that he's left us with, his homework assignments. I started the conversation by saying, make sure you not only have his book on the shelf, but it's well-read and well-worn. Over the next few years, you will need to refer to it. The things that he referred to in a conversation today, Christine Lagarde's comments at Jackson Hole, and,
right,
and the increase of capital controls or exchange controls, and sort of the diminishment of, if that were to take place, it's a major sea change in terms of globalization and the trend of international trade. You find that countries in that space and time with those policies are thinking more of themselves uniquely, not just the sort of collective global citizenry.
Well, Dave, I'm imagining the second part of the assignment you're thinking of is this command economy that's being revealed right on the internet to us. These guys are not keeping it secret. They're telling us they will be the seen hand.
Well, exactly. The Bank of England, as Russell mentioned, going and looking at their financial policy committee notes, and this is really important. Just like Ben Bernanke gave us insight in 2002 into what extraordinary measures measures would be in place in the context of the crisis we've walked through over the last 5 years. We have the playbook in terms of government playing a larger role in the world of allocating finance, becoming, as he mentioned, more of a commercial entity. And of course, that comes with great dangers in terms of rationing capital. Who gets it? Yes, it's government itself. Yes, it's those connected to government. And yes, it's those who vote for those in power. That is inherently corrupt. That is the nature of what we face over the next several years. Structural issues, which, again, we need to better understand to be making wise decisions.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Russell Napier. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.